नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि।
This morning, after the meal, Numpur asked if I would speak tonight, and then he mumbled something about it being a kind of going away gift, which I kind of puzzled me. I wasn't quite sure what he meant by that. Is a going away gift to me? If so, I think he's a little mistaken about how much I enjoy talking, at least in this kind of way. I clearly like enjoy talking, but I haven't yet got to the stage where I love giving Dhamma talks. So I thought he must have meant sort of a gift to him and the other Ajahns. So, and that's the only one that makes sense for me, at least. Despite their deep compassion and goodwill, I'm sure they love giving Dhamma talks about as much as I do. I actually remember when I was a young monk, how despite my best efforts, a certain amount of my mind in listening to a Dhamma talk was always critically kind of evaluating the talk, sort of like, oh, that's a good point, and oh, that's not such a good point, or oh, he didn't really tell the story very well there, or really? Five khandhas again? Are we metta? What? But then once you become a bit more senior and you have some sort of responsibility, or I guess here it's kind of you're on the roster or something. That all just sort of ends, and you just kind of sit there and you just kind of inwardly sort of smile. It's just whatever they say, it's delightful, you know, because you don't have to talk. That's all you care about anymore. It's like, oh, God, it's so nice somebody else is talking. It's especially true when you're at the top of the line or when you're the only person who's willing to give talks. Which is often the case. I've found myself in the last kind of 4 years being up at the Pacific Hermitage. Jogananda is still very adamantly opposed to not just the idea that he'll be an Ajahn soon, but the idea that he would be responsible for talking on Dhamma in this particular way. He's okay talking about it in other less informal ways. So I'll be departing in a couple of days, as most people know, early Thursday morning. I'm going to head off to spend a few weeks visiting the monasteries in England and attending some meetings there. And then going off to start my sabbatical retreat in proper, which is kind of like the real sabbatical in a sense, something I'm really looking forward to after... Almost 4 years ago, myself and Venerable Jogananda and Venerable Tithapo departed from here to move up to the Pacific Northwest and establish a branch monastery. And I'm sure most of you know the story. And I always hear reports that Lumpur and the monks here sharing bits of news all the time about what goes on up there. So I won't bore you with the details. It's been a really kind of exciting, amazing, interesting experiment setting up a new community the way we did that up there, the new friends, how well it's gone, how well it's been supported and received by the local community, and also personally for me, just kind of shifting into a slightly different mode of my monastic life and practice. And that's interesting. And most of it's been really enjoyable. Some of it's been hard work, but most of it's been really enjoyable. And especially, I'd say, over the last year or something, as some of the newness has worn off. And it's starting to kind of take shape and in some way become just what it is and kind of routine. We kind of worship newness in this culture. Everybody gets all excited about that which is new. But, you know, that which is new is expensive, exciting in the sense that it disturbs the peace. It's hard work. And in a sense, this is the heart of the practice that we aim for is fragile, and so I kind of welcome that kind of fading of that sort of newness and kind of moving into something of a more settled kind of pattern up there, so that more and more the focus can be practice and the simplicity of a small alms-faring group of monastics practicing in the context of a local community. That's quite wonderful. It's been very delightful, sort of having the opportunity to come down and spend a couple weeks again with the community here and find the monastery in such fine shape, full of so many good people, new friends, old friends, to have been treated so kind of kindly. Everyone's been very nice and friendly and supportive in so many different ways, and the work monk never assigned me any tasks, and I never asked for any. It's been kind of wonderful. I'm sort of trying to sort of prepare myself for 10 months of solitary retreat. You know, as you can imagine, sort of all the preparations to sort of leave for a year entail a lot of thought and work and planning. Towards the end of it, I was really kind of lamenting the idea that I was going away, even. It was like, it'd be a lot easier just to shut myself in my cootie. There's all these questions about travel insurance and healthcare and visas and people filling in for this and that and all kinds of contingency plans. So being here for a couple of weeks has been very nice, just to kind of to rest, to practice, to read, to kind of reconnect with the Sangha here. And I imagine the few weeks I'll have in England will be a nice extension of that. And then I'll go off to start a period of solitary retreat at Birkin Monastery. Ajahn Sona and the community there has offered to support me living in solitude in one of the kutis up there. And their monastery is a very quiet and kind of remote place. And I'm excited about that. It's a kind of a beautiful and rare opportunity. It's many people keep asking me, have you ever done that? Have you ever spent that much time alone? And several of our friends in White Salmon kind of shake their head and say, boy, I don't think I'd ever want to do that. You have a year away from your duties and you choose to kind of go be all alone in the forest and many times the questions were, how does that sort of fit? So like, did Ajahn Pasano make, is he making you do that? Or is that something that happens when you get 20 pansas and you have to kind of go away and be sequestered all alone and kind of prove your mettle? Or something. So I've had all kinds of interesting discussions with people. No, this is what I chose. Like, you know, I sort of asked the community, can I take a year off to focus on my personal practice? And you know, my thought certainly was sort of wide open, like just a year away from responsibilities. And, you know, I thought, well, there's many ways I could spend that time or spend that year that would be fruitful and perfectly acceptable for a monk. You know, visiting various communities, etc. But when I reflected what do I want to do most, I kept coming back to this sense that I've had at the end of some of the better retreats I've had over the last few years, which is I wish this had a little more space and a little more time. When I was thinking about this year, I thought, well, this would be a good time to give yourself that space and that time to explore what happens when you go past the 2 month or the 3 month mark of retreat. And I'm very much excited and looking forward to that. I've kind of arranged the time to be in solitude and but when I think of a time of practice like that, it's not so much, you know, oftentimes talking to people that it's like there's this image of austerity that strikes them, like can you make it 10 months without seeing another person, without talking to another person, etc., etc. And I don't really think of it that way so much. It's like I think of the opportunity to live in that way more is just like a gift, like not, you don't have to engage with other people. You don't have to have a responsibility. You don't have to speak and engage with other people. It's just giving yourself that kind of unfettered space to really explore practice, and in particular, putting forth right effort. So I have a few things I'm excited about exploring and doing over that 10 months. You know, one is spending some time refining and deepening samatha practice. Some of it's doing some chanting. Like I'm going to be doing probably some daily chanting, memorizing the Padimokkha again. And then just trying to sort of live in a way that is light and free and affords the opportunity to really find a balance in putting forth effort at understanding the heart and especially understanding how it is that this heart, this mind, creates suffering and how it can create the conditions for the release from those very kind of habits of dukkha. I was thinking a little bit earlier today, a thought that often kind of comes to my mind, and I find it somewhat awesome and bewildering even, is just how difficult, even as a monk or even in the context of living and practicing in monastic communities, how difficult it is to keep dukkha kind of front and center. And the image that kind of popped into my mind is actually this beautiful image from the suttas that's used as a symbol or as an image of purity, and it's a symbol of the lotus. And there's various places in the suttas where the lotus is brought, evoked as this kind of image. It kind of grows up out of the mud through the water and the rests on top of the water. And in particular, what came to my mind was, you know, how the lotus leaf sort of, it, although it's in the water or it sits on top of the water, it's not wetted by the water. If you drop a little drop of water on the kind of the lily or the leaf or something, it just beads up and rolls off like a marble. It's a very kind of beautiful image of how the mind that's liberated, or, you know, even one who's developed, you know, sort of perfection of purity, how the mind is not sullied or stained by the things of the world. But when I thought of it this morning, I thought of it as this kind of inverse sort of analogy or image, because the experience of the practitioners, like, you know, intent on contemplating dukkha, intent on seeing dukkha, like intent on understanding dukkha, it's awesome how little time we actually spend framing our experience and contemplating our experience in that way. It's as if the mind is repelled, just in the same way the water is repelled from the leaf of a lily or a lotus. And in some sense, that's why I relish this opportunity to spend my life as a monastic, and to live in monastic community, and have the support of good Kalyanamita and the teachings, because it is a practice, kind of to remember that, to recollect that, and to try to bring yourself back time and time again to the heart of trying to understand dukkha. And the mind doesn't want to see it. It's just like the contemplations on aging, sickness, and death. You know, the normal mind is repelled by these subjects, and it finds it hard to, in any sort of wholesome way, stay kind of engaged with them for very long. So often we're framing our experience in any number of alternate sort of ways, as if to kind of keep ourselves from really seeing the truth of dukkha. We meet some disagreeable sort of feeling. Somebody violates our kind of expectations in this way or that way. We experience pain, bodily pain, sensual pain, foul smells, etc. Where does the mind go? You know, so often it goes to a feeling of sourness, sometimes blaming the world, sometimes blaming ourselves, sometimes blaming others. Rarely does it recognize that experience as the first noble truth. Rarely does it recognize that truth of dukkha. Ah, this is suffering. This is difficult to bear. This kind of weighs upon the mind. And even if we're somewhat aware of the weight or the pain, we're aware that we're suffering. It's rarely kind of held in that sense of this is the universal truth of suffering. You know, it's maybe personalized, but this is my suffering, or it's tainted with some other aberrant, delusory kind of thought, like suffering is permanent. Suffering is permanent, suffering is self. Our suffering is sure. And so when I think of the time I have looking forward to something, I really establish that kind of as job one, or as the kind of ultimate like goal, is to use all the various tools and practices and the knowledge I've developed over my life as a monk to try to create the most supportive conditions to establish that very delicate balance that supports seeing dukkha clearly, seeing it straight forward and straight on, seeing it through this kind of liberating lens of the Four Noble Truths. This is dukkha. Here's the cause. Here's the cessation. Here is the way I apply right effort to skillfully engage and to skillfully support the mind moving towards the experience of release from that, and the diminishing of and the loosening of the habits that lead to that sort of repeated sort of experience. Over the winter, one of the things I was doing was going back and revisiting these English translations of Ajahn Chah's teachings. Two of the things that struck me the most, kind of coming back and rereading them and going through them, was one, just the sense of lightness and encouragement that's almost there. Like, you can do this. Human beings can do this. You monks here in the monastery, you can do this. And he speaks about practice in a very kind of straightforward way, but there's something of this tone in there of like, I did this, and it doesn't take somebody who's superhuman. If you just apply yourself with sincerity and effort and mindfulness and discernment, you can awaken. You can see these habits of the mind and the heart and how it is that you create suffering. And you can learn from that kind of questioning. Hey, that's not right. Someone does this, someone says that, and I think this. And we can notice that, and we can question, hey, is that right? Is that the right way to hold that? Is that the right way to respond? And through this, we can change and we can grow in ways that are truly profound and liberating. Well, that was one thing. And the other thing, is something that many of his disciples have commented and made much of, and it's just his emphasis on the importance of right view and right effort, or in some sense the centrality of those two parts of the path in particular. You know, his teachings I think are very full teaching, and there's all kinds of elements there, but it seems like the thing that he highlights and holds up and mentions the most and emphasizes is just the importance of right view in our practice and the importance of effort, and in particular right effort. Even more so than I think a lot of the specifics, like, you know, the technique of how you practice, or whether you're a monk or whether you're a layperson, or whether you're a young monk or an old monk, or, you know, what conditions you're practicing in, or how peaceful the mind is. You know, there's one talk in particular where I think a bunch of Western monks are pressing him, and They're wanting him to quantify sort of how peaceful does the mind need to be to really develop true wisdom or some sort of, you know, transformative insight. And he just rebuffs them again and again and again. And comes back to sort of, you know, just something that's like is peaceful enough, or, you know, the mind doesn't have, there's even some places, you know, where he's like, the mind doesn't have to be that peaceful, you know. And he's, and the way I read it is he's coming back and just sort of emphasizing how much more important it is that you're kind of observing and asking the right questions. And I take that to mean you're seeing things through this investigative lens of the Four Noble Truths. Or you're contemplating things in light of the characteristics, which is very much the way I like to sort of approach the practice, is, you know, constantly keeping at hand this kind of this reflection, this skill, this lens of like examining my experience in light of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. So that's my map for the year, really. After all these years, not so many really, but that's my map for practice. Fairly simple, fairly direct. The rest, I trust I can work out, as long as there's true, curious, sincere desire to understand suffering in a very direct, very kind of profound way, and the willingness to sort of meet it with the requisite effort to get underneath it and to penetrate it. I offer these words for your reflection tonight. Andamayam dhamma kataya sadhukaram gadamase.